Welcome to the Corporate Venturing Insider Series, where I interview top practitioners in the CVC world and learn with you the best practices and golden nuggets that they have accumulated over their careers. This week, you will be hearing a conversation I had with Joseph Lee Puma, professor at Boston University. Joe, could you take a few minutes to share your story and how you got to where you are today?
After my MBA years ago, I started working for various companies in technology and then went to a number of startups. And a number of these startups that I worked for were VC-backed. They're very interesting rides. Some were very aggressive up and down. Some failed. And then I decided that I wanted to move to Europe. Moved to Europe, did that for a while and did some traveling. Took a year off and traveled and decided to go back and do my PhD in business and in strategy. And particularly in international entrepreneurship. The companies that I had worked for were young companies, and I was the person who took these companies internationally. I started subsidiaries for companies in the UK, Saudi Arabia, Bay Area, which is a foreign country when you're coming from Boston. And one of the things I noticed as I was starting to do my research and my doctoral studies was looking at the fact that most of the companies, the young companies that went international early in their lives, were technology-based companies. And I looked at venture capital, and most of the companies that get venture capital are young and technology companies. And I wanted to explore that. Is there some correlation? Is there some relationship between the receipt of venture capital and internationalizing of these young companies? And then if there is, what is the performance of the internationalization path? Do these companies do better when they go public? And just really dig into this whole idea of venture capital. I also started looking at foreign venture capital since I was interested in the internationalization process. Do we see that foreign venture capital differentially affects the internationalization of these young companies?
I think what's interesting about your journey is that you started with VC-backed startups. So you got the exposure to VCs from getting funding from them. Is there anything you remember from that time where you thought, that does not make sense? And today, it makes sense to you.
Well, one of the things that I remember a VC saying when we were first talking, I was with this company that was, I think about 40 people when I joined, and I had been pushing internationalization just because I grew up in Buffalo near the Canadian border. I used to get up there all the time, and I was just always interested in this. And he said, my view of internationalization is you take $2 million, you put it on a 747. When you're over the Atlantic, you open up the doors and let it all blow out. So it was very much this, I don't think that's the way to go, he was saying. And that didn't make sense to me because when we look at the fact that for most companies, the bigger market is outside their domestic market. Yeah. Internationalization is important. So that was just the opposite in terms of, did that really catch me? Yeah, it did, but not in a way that I thought it should and it would.
So you mentioned there were startups that were VC-backed, but did you have any CVC investing in any of the startups you worked at the time?
No.
Now, I want to ask because I think you did an MBA and then you did a PhD in business. What was the rationales for going for that PhD and go even deeper?
I've always had this teaching mindset and mentality. And it just made sense for me to say, okay, if I'm going to do this, let me go to university, get my chops in terms of being able to have the bona fides in terms of the doctorate and get in there and teach and do that and start digging in and doing some interesting research. I'll joke about the fact that when I finished my doctorate, I could still get student discounts, but I also was eligible for AARP discounts. Well, yeah, I was 50 years old when I got my PhD, so.
Very nice. And I mean, I'm French, and I saw that in one of your interviews. You went to Lyon, and the school, which is a really good school, moved from 95% of classes in French to 95% in English within 3 years of you joining. And I think it's important because when we think about Europe, sometimes we are very protective of our culture, but we may miss something bigger because of that. So I wanted to have your sense because you lived through a transition that probably was very interesting and some friction, I'm guessing.
Yeah, well, I'll modify that a little bit. You know, in Lyon, the Grand Ecoles, they have a number of programs there. Master Specialisé program is mainly in French. I had transformed at least the faculty meetings went from 95% in French to 90+% in English. And one of the aspects of the school. It was educating entrepreneurs for the world. Really wanted to be an international university. And my point going in was, if you want to be international, we have to be speaking the international language. International business language is English. So we have to be doing that. And it was challenging. And I would say probably there was sometimes a love-hate relationship with me because I kept pushing this, we have to do this in English. But there is this, as you say, giving up the heritage in terms of doing this. And that wasn't at all the intent. The intent was to open up more options and open up more possibilities and make the knowledge, make the research that was done there more accessible.
I remember when, I went 8 years in England, and then I joined a French company, a French startup. It was 20 people. But I remember one of my questions, which was a deal breaker, was, are you emailing each other in English or in French? And if it had been in French, I would not have joined, because that would have just been too tough, and the internationalization and all of that. So I can get that. Now, there's something you said, which I think was a joke, but there's always some truth behind the joke. You said the Bay Area is like a foreign country. Can you explain a little bit what you meant by that? Because I think there's something very special about the Bay Area, and sometimes people wonder, why can't we just replicate it somewhere else?
Yes, there's a lot of things that are very specific and special about that. Some of it is cultural. That's one of the things I've been working a lot here at Boston University over the past couple of years, is helping our students really understand differences in countries and the cultural differences and how those really affect business and the like. There's a book that was written in 1984 by Annalise Sexanian. It was called Regional Advantage. And it really talked about the development, I think 1994, the development of the Bay Area versus development of Route 128 in Boston. And there are a number of reasons why. You know, they started about the same time in terms of the computer industry, it built up, and then kind of things shifted out to the West Coast, to the Bay Area. And some of the aspects of this were geographic. Why it both built up in Bay Area, you had ocean on one side, and you had mountains on the other side. In Boston, you had this Route 128 area that kind of grabbed things. But then you started getting into aspects of regulations and rules in the Bay Area. Non-compete contracts were unenforceable. That was the case in Boston, so that limited people moving around. The other thing is where VCs came from. In the Bay Area, VCs generally came from, they had been entrepreneurs. They had been in startups. They understood the mentality. In Boston, in Route 128, most of them came from finance. They were bankers and others. So their mindset was very different. So you had all these differences in terms of the mindset of funding, the mindset of risk, the mindset of loyalty. Here we had Data General and Digital Equipment and Wayne Laboratories. And when someone left Digital Equipment or Data General, when they left, it was like, you're dead to us. Whereas that wasn't the case at Fairchild in the Bay Area. It's like, they spawned all these fair children, right? And it was, hey, somebody's starting out a company. This is great, right? So there's these cultural aspects that coincided with risk-taking perspectives of the investors that really made big cultural differences that got really embedded.
I think what you said is so strong, and you can feel it even when you work a few years in the Bay Area. But I want to go back to your first point, which I think is so profound, and it was very lucky, which was a non-compete, not being possible to do in California. And that was because of the Orchard, where people had to be able to move between Orchard. And what's interesting is that it drives so much different behaviors if you know that people can move freely between companies.
Yeah, and not only could they move freely, but they didn't have to even relocate to move there. And so they could still go to the same social environment, social settings, talk to their buds or their friends from the last company. And we talk about these things. And so you didn't have, certainly you wouldn't disclose things. Non-disclosure agreements were still enforced, but people could move around and still talk about things. And that just made it work. There was an openness.
I think fast forward 50 years, I think Fairchild, you're looking at talent density that build over time, and a talent fluidity, and an exchange of information. which Iberia can leverage so well when there's a new technology, even AI with OpenAI. And every, I'm sure there will be an OpenAI mafia very soon where every startup slings back, and you already see the graphs showing that. So I want to touch about the fragmented exit market, because here I think this is where corporate VCs could play a role, which maybe they haven't played as much. How do you see corporate VCs being able to create more fluidity, not just to support the startups, but to help with a better internationalization, for sure, but also an exit path?
The ones that do corporate venture capital are generally larger, more multinational companies. They have the means to acquire companies. That's the way that many of them end up exiting, is through acquisition. So they've got the means to be able to do that. So that's an important piece. And there's been a lot of talk about, is corporate venture capital just a try before you buy kind of thing? The research doesn't really show that is always the motivation. The motivation for this is more strategic than it is purely financial. The other piece in terms of the growth and internationalization of these companies that get them into broader markets is that corporations, again, mostly multinationals who are doing CVC, have a foreign footprint, have relationships. They have market knowledge. They may have manufacturing facilities or R&D facilities in other countries that they can utilize, or that the portfolio company that they invest in could utilize. So it helps them to drag that company into a foreign market where they can expand the business much more readily. So this is where CVC units could do a lot more, is they could pull their portfolio companies into more global realms because of their reach, because of the fact that they are other places. And I don't know how aggressively the CVC partners in these companies are actually doing that. I remember talking with the head of Dell Ventures in Israel. He came up through the technology area. He wasn't a finance person. And so Dell may be doing it right if they are, in fact, utilizing his knowledge and skills. And Dell Ventures in Israel has done very well for itself.
Now, there's one thing you mentioned. I want to go back because it's important to understand the bubble of that you mentioned earlier and how it's influenced investors moving forward. And it's interesting because you have the investors who survived the bubbles. They went through that and they have still scars. And then we have all the new investors from the last 15 years who haven't seen it. And they've only seen the ups. And now, of course, you have gone out of the zero interest rate zone. And so it starts to look like the bubble for some, and it looks like totally foreign for others. How do you contextualize today versus the bubble from 25 years ago?
Yeah, I remember talking to someone who's an allergy on this, an American baseball allergy analogy. These people were born on third base and thought they had a triple, right? Because that was so easy for them to just be, look at what I've done here. I'm really far ahead. I think potential now is for some of this stuff that we're doing with AI and the like to create some of the same bubble that existed in 2000, in that bubble. I think companies are dealing with things a little better. We've gone through this a couple times now. It's in terms of some other geopolitical and political economic turbulence that's going on, and uncertainty that's going into things. So what does that augur? And I think some of it might be in terms of our corporations going to have to do more and step into more of the role that government may have played in terms of fostering investment in public goods. And so if corporations have to step more into that, then what does that mean potentially for CVCs in their role looking to help find these opportunities and to pursue and push and nurture them? So just different dynamics and different times. We've seen this play before, though, in terms of new technology. Everybody bubbles it up. This has happened a number of times over the last 30 years. We all rush to put our new AI units in our companies, or same thing has happened 20 years ago. We all put our new web and internet, and then it was social media. We all put our social media things and get that whole bubble going. So we've learned a bit. AI is different, though. I think that my concern on some of the AI stuff and talent diversity is that an over-reliance on AI everybody has the same knowledge. You know, I tell students, you know, you go out there, there's 10 of you sitting around a table at your new job, you get a question come up, you all jump on your computers and you work in AI there to get the answer. Why do they need 9 of you? All I need is 1 of you to write a prompt, right? And so what we're finding is that as people are doing more and more of this, the answers start becoming narrower and more congruent with each other. And we're losing some of that diversity because these models are trained up on all this stuff and they're pulling it together. And so we're losing a little bit of that diversity. And I think the big challenge is, how do we get that diversity back in to these things to take advantage of what AI affords us?
That's a very good question. Because indeed, when you have 10 people, hopefully you have good diversity, you have 10 brains. But if these 10 brains go and ask exactly the same prompt because they're thinking of the same problem the same way, you never had diversity to start with, but then you end up with one type of answers. And so I'm interested by your research because you're looking at how AI could affect, in a way, the knowledge workers. What do you think is the extreme view of that impact?
I think there's going to be a pullback. We have the capability now to share information so readily, and that's what's made this, that's what makes LLMs work. I think there's going to be more barriers and companies putting up walls. We see this in terms of issues about privacy coming up. We see the way in which Japan and Europe and US are differentially looking at AI regulations. For younger companies, one of the difficulties for them is, in order to really put together a strategy and you want to use AI for that, you have to be able to articulate kind of the totality of your business model, which in some of that may be it's not even, it may be more tacit to you because you've been in this industry for so long, right? It's not well codified. If you were going to try and codify your whole business model to be able to type that into a prompt, you probably couldn't even do that, right? So this becomes a big impediment where a company that's been around for a long time, it has strategy documents and has annual reports and has financial information, they can build up a whole model quite easily with the data that they have already.
Let's think about the future of corporate VCs in the world of AI. Because I think we are getting a good framework of mind here where you need these companies, if they want to leverage AI, to get more of their own views and data and framing it well. I think there's also a point, I mean, I don't think globalization is dying, but it's definitively becoming more challenging, more difficult, more complex. Anytime something becomes more complex, that's an opportunity to develop new type of innovations, whether it's business model or technology.
And that complexity, the more complex things get, especially with internationalization, the more skills companies are developing because they have to deal with that more complex environment, right? So those that enter into the more complex environment by internationalizing, by trying to expand broadly, are the ones who are going to win because they know how to deal with more uncertainty and more complexity. And that's something that's, I think, difficult for, even though AI can help some of these things on a very functional level, when we're trying to move across functions, that complexity becomes very difficult to deal with for AI.
Absolutely. So let's put it to the test. Let's assume that you just joined a company. It was a family company, but they did really well. They are $1 billion revenue, slightly profitable, and they're thinking about internationalization for the first time. And one of the first questions your board is asking is, do we need a CVC? How would you make the case for or against?
For internationalization, I would think there's other prerequisites before getting to the CVC. When I look at the things that companies need for internationalization, I have a bunch of different aspects of knowledge that they need to get to kind of before they think about the money part of it. That said, I would think about, I guess the big question would be, what's the nature of this $1 billion family company? Is it something that is in a space where having specialized investors who have technology or other domain or international knowledge is important? I think that's one of the big questions. I think that the corporate venture capital piece gets into what's the means for supporting internationalization. I think other questions first are, why do you want to do this? And where do you want to go? And what are the conditions there? And what are the regulations and all these other things? And then we got to figure out how much money we're going to need to do all that.
Yeah, perfect answer. I think when being pushed on the question of starting a CVC, it's all about strategy. Why Does it support the strategy? And if it doesn't have a strong why, don't start it.
No, it's tough. I mean, unless you're just hanging out on X number of millions or billions of dollars that you don't know what to do with and you're willing to just throw the dice on it, it's tough to get that. You have to get your board to buy into that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So let me ask a question, which is, it relates to anything in corporate venturing, but beyond that, anyway, what do you look for when you recruit someone?
I look for someone being open to hear things. And I also see someone who's open to say things. I think that's an important piece. My job as a manager is to find and utilize and exploit those talents in a positive meaning of the word exploit and put them together with others who are doing the best thing. So that's what I see. What can you do better than me?
And that's one of your interview questions then. You try to assess that part.
Yeah. If they haven't come to the interview knowing who I am, that's a problem. But if they do come in and I say, what can you do better than me? And that's not a challenge to you. It's just, I want to understand that. That's what's going to make it work with this team is we all do something better and we all figure out how we work together.
I like it a lot. Now, on the being open to say things, how do you manage to get that during an interview? I can see how you open it and you try to make them comfortable, but how do you assess it?
I think it'd be asking a provocative question of some sort and just seeing their comfort or willingness to answer something more provocative. And it doesn't have to be, in this case, it could be something about things we've talked about, right? About AI. What do you think AI is going to be able to do? Tell me, or I think that it's going to be this. Some people say, do you agree with that? What do you think? And just getting them to share something where they're speculating, I think that's important. There's not one single answer in business. If there was, there'd be one company. And although Meta and the rest of them and Microsoft are trying to be that one company, they're not there yet. So there's not one right answer in business. Speculate.
I think you just gave me the perfect opening for my final question. And be as provocative as you can be, but how do you speculate the future of corporate VC, so CVCs, in a way that everyone should think about moving forward?
I think recognizing that corporations, businesses are going to have to reconsider their role in terms of providing things for public goods in an area where governments are pulling back, retrenching on things, and recognizing that these companies that are multinationals, larger companies that have CDC units, play in different places in the world. And in order to make that work, they have to use that distance, use that breadth to sense, to find things, find new ideas, find companies, and bring them together. I think that is one of the big things. And to bring them together for solving these things solving these public needs.
It's a great way to finish a podcast, a really nice golden nugget. Joe, thank you very much for your time today with us.
Thank you for asking provocative questions. It was really enjoyable. So thank you for that.